Welcome to the SASMA podcast, your source for the latest insights in sports medicine. Designed for healthcare professionals, we cover everything from injury prevention to athlete performance and mental health, helping you stay informed and excel in your field. Let's dive in.
Good day and welcome to the special episode of the SASMA podcast. Today, I am joined live at the 15th Advanced Team Physician course in Rome, Italy. I am joined by Adam Weir, Hans Toll, and Rod Whiteley, all actively involved in the sport and exercise medicine field, to discuss hamstring injuries and an approach to a challenging injury in practice. Let's start with an example of an athlete that comes to our clinic with sudden onset posterior thigh pain, some bruising and ecchymosis, and decreased range of motion. What would your approach be to work up this athlete?
I think from my side, the two main cornerstones are going to be your history and the clinical examination. 99% of useful information we need will be gathered in this stage with a good patient history and a thorough clinical examination. Anything to add to that?
Yeah. Possibly the only trap to worry about there is this sounds a lot like it's just not just a hamstring strain, but a hamstring injury that you're going to confirm or otherwise by a clinical exam. But the presence of bruising in the area would mean that one of the things that you're going to have to rule out is that the patient hasn't actually completely ruptured, and potentially a surgical consult might be required in this case.
So that's indeed a red flag. Eh? So clinical examination for me always starts with palpation of the insertion, the proximal insertion. And when there's no pain over there, then you're almost sure that there's no full avulsion. But also palpate the rest of the tendon. And the trick is, because it's difficult to palpate, to ask him to flex the knee a little bit. Then you'll really feel the tendon touching your fingers, and then you know if it's ruptured or not.
Yeah, so I guess, I mean, do you feel that an MRI classification or what classification should we use to assist us with any prognosis or treatment?
Classification can be useful, but it can also make you really, really, really lazy. So first of all, start with describing your history, start with describing your physical examination. And when you jump to an MRI, it still start with describing the MRI. Which muscle is involved? Which structure is involved? Is it the intramuscular tendon? Is it the free tendon? Or is it the myotendinous junction? And describe it. And then secondly, you describe the degree of edema and the degree of disruption. But the key message here, don't forget to describe the injury and don't make yourself too lazy to jump to just a 3A or a 3C from a classification system.
So, yeah, you can add in, Adam.
No, I think I would sort of emphasize what Hans says as well about the clinical examination being key. What's the extent of pain or palpation? What's the degree of loss of strength? What's the degree of loss of flexibility and how painful is that? I'm sure we'll cover that in rehab as well, but they are also giving you clues as maybe where you would start with rehabilitation as well as getting an impression of the severity of the injury clinically.
And Rod really can tell you what the value is of repeated clinical examination.
Yeah, thanks, Hans. That was something we looked at a lot because initially we thought that, you know, the once-off initial examination would be enough to be prognostic, but it turns out it's the trajectory. So somebody who starts off really well, but a week later they're basically unchanged, is probably not going to do as well as somebody who maybe starts off looking pretty bad, that a week later they've markedly improved. That trajectory of improvement seems to really be helpful in determining your prognosis.
Yeah, so I guess the big question I think for sports and exercise practitioners is, so what do you tell the coach or the manager that, you know, they've got their player's got a hamstring strain, you know, return to play can be anywhere from a few days to a few weeks to return. I mean, what predictors would you be using to observe any improvement in their clinical status?
The key things would be on day one to try and not pin yourself down to something that you're going to be made a monkey of in open court later. So do that examination, but make sure everybody knows that what we're really going to be able to tell you is in about a week's time, watch how these things are tracking, and then make sure that you're giving good feedback and follow up on all of those things. So coaches, and probably for that matter players, don't really understand terribly well my length of pain palpation changed in this, or my flexibility changed on that. But one that they will all be able to get a handle on is how fast the patient is running. So if in that first week they're only able to run at what they call 10% of their maximum, but 7 days later they're up to either 20% or 50%, then that's something that everybody can get a handle on. And occasionally it'll actually change your management. For example, a player might get up to, let's say, 80% of their maximum. You don't think they're ready to go back to play, but the coach says, no, this guy, I can put him in a position where that's all he's going to do, and I just need him to control the midfield or something. He's not going to sprint, and we'll take him at only 80%.
Maybe in addition to that, in the case that you described, we were talking about ecchymosis, so that would possibly suggest a more severe injury. Could also be that somebody has tweaked something and then played on for 60 minutes and it's bled more with a mild injury, with a larger hematoma. But in general, I think if you do a baseline assessment on day one or day two and there would be no ecchymosis and everything is very mild, you're really struggling to find some pain on palpation, the proximal tendon is free of pain, they can produce good force with a small amount of pain, I think that my clinical experience would kind of bear out that these cases aren't going to be the ones that are out for a long period of time. So if your initial assessment is, all seems very mild, I would say that will be a good prognostic sign. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, in history, you have to know the player to give at least a rough prognosis. Yeah? It completely depends which position the team. Is he a real attacker? Is he very explosive? Was it a running injury, a stress injury? There are many, many things you have to take into account that you don't see on MRI.
Okay, and I mean, so, you know, could we use any injectables, or is there anything that could assist us in speeding up the healing process?
You can give it a try, but it will not work. The evidence is clear about it. It does not work.
Yeah, I'd agree there. I'd say for many things in sports medicine, we're unsure, there's not great evidence one way or the other. And I'd say that in an acute hamstring injury, we actually have good evidence to say that it's not going to help. So in this one, I think we can be clear and direct that there's no indication for injectables in these cases.
And maybe the only contraindication would be occasionally people will say that they want to do an injection, but after the injection, you're not allowed to do any loading for 3 days. Those 3 days are going to cost you at least another week at the back end of your return to sport.
Yeah, and then the study from Denmark in New England, they showed the earlier you start with loading, the earlier you start with rehab, the quicker you have to return to play. But it's not always about a quick return to play, because on the other hand, you also have the re-injury rates. So on one hand, you want to start as soon as possible with the rehab, but we also know every 7 days, every day that you, 1 week you wait with delaying your return to play, your relative risk of re-injury will decrease by 7%. So now and then delaying like we did in the old days is not a bad option.
And I mean, in terms of our rehab and our loading, what should we be doing with the athlete?
It would be nice to be able to tell you we know exactly the parameters of the dose, the frequency, the type, but truth be told, we don't. We simply know that loading is better than no loading. We have some ideas that, for example, being able to get your patient up to the level that they can do heavy eccentric loading at least a couple of times during their rehabilitation probably has some positive effects for things like muscle architecture, which have been associated with less re-injury rates. But honestly, we really don't know the loading type. If you had to pin me down, I'd say I want to be trying to do heavier loading rather than light loading, and I'd like to get some overloading in there. Of course, they're not just a hamstring injury in that leg. There's the entire rest of the body, so the other leg needs to be loaded, and it's an opportunity while they can't do all their normal running and kicking to perhaps address some things that maybe have been grumbling along with this athlete prior to this injury.
Yeah, I think you can see every injury as an opportunity as well. And for sure, if there are other things going on, Achilles or you name it, that this is also an opportunity to work on that while you're out. And I think that gives also a sense of self-efficacy as well, that you're being busy keeping as fit as you can in those initial stages, definitely.
Yeah, and I think it's also an important opportunity, as you say, to know your multidisciplinary network in terms of referrals and who to approach, who to use, because they'll be also vital in getting this patient back more effectively. So, I mean, I think the last thing is, you know, should we consider surgery? And if so, when should we consider it?
I think when you look at the hamstrings, the complete avulsions of the free tendon, and each elite athlete, you have to consider it. And I think most of them nowadays, they get an operation when there's a full rupture of the free tendon, so complete avulsion. And there's a big debate if you have to operate on all these intramuscular tendon injuries. I don't see the advantage on operating on all these injuries, because they will all recover. Normally it will take probably 1 week longer, but at the end the re-injury rate will be exactly the same and even lower than on the musculotendon junction injury. But for sure, Wartel also have an opinion on this one. So operating on intramuscular tendon injuries.
We're not aware of any evidence that you get back any quicker or that your re-injury rate is any lower. If it does turn out to be the case, we'll happily change our mind when the evidence presents itself. But until that time, I think you'd have to say that if you were asking the patient to make an informed choice, you'd have to say that the outcomes for conservative compared to operative care are at worst the same without having an operation. And there might even be the argument that you can get back a little bit quicker without surgery.
And in addition, the center that Hans works at in Amsterdam is the tertiary center for proximal avulsions of the tendons in Holland. And you've collected some really nice data, which I think is also the first time that you've seen high quality data come out on this. And to me, as an outsider looking at the data, I think it just shows that it's a severe injury and that there's no miracle cure one way or the other. So both with conservative and surgery, there's an awful lot of patients, athletes having residual symptoms even a year following the injury. So I think it's important in terms of managing expectations to be clear about that. Obviously, if someone's an elite level athlete, the aim is going to be to get back there. But we have to be frank and honest that that's not always achievable. And it's not like surgery is a magic bullet, like we sew it back on, we put some anchors in, and then they all do fantastically.
Yeah, thank you. And I think, again, as you say, it's about best knowing your athlete, the type of patient that you're dealing with, what their expectations, their ideas, concerns, and all of that are. And obviously just giving them the realistic, even if it's a hard truth, but best opinion that you can provide them with. So yeah, I really do appreciate your time this afternoon, and thank you for giving of your insight, your wisdom and experience to today's talk.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.